I
was trying to set up the story.
Jesus.
And now you've cut in with this ridiculous. I don't think we've ever got into an argument this quickly on the show. Hello and welcome to episode 141 of the High Level Showdown, part of the Alberta Podcast Network, powered by ATB. My name is Michael. I am joined by Elliot and Sharon on episode 141. How are you guys doing?
I'm great.
I'm feeling weird today, guys. It's going to be a weird show.
You're feeling weird. What's up?
I don't know.
Something. Just
feeling weird. Feeling weird.
Well,
midweek,
you know, the
jitters.
Sharon's
giving me attitude since she walked in the door. I don't know what her problem is. Michael keeps talking like Freddy. It's going to be a weird show.
Well, you know, when you follow, the politics daily, and you do encounter a lot of weird things sometimes, and I guess sometimes it rubs off on us. So let's start off.
Great segue.
Weird. You want to see a weird show, folks? The weird political show, the United Nations. So it is September 26th today, and you know, kids in September, of course, they go back to school, and you know, come back from summer holidays, and all the political kids come back to the UN in September, of course, for the annual meeting of the General Assembly. So the UN has reconvened, of course, and world leaders descend on the UN. And that includes, of course, the Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau. So we're going to talk a little bit about Trudeau's visit to the UN and, had several reasons for his visit, of course. So let's start off with one of those, and that is courting the Security Council members because, well, Canada wants to join the Security Council once again. Now, we did lose that seat under the Harper Conservative government, and, for many in Canada, it was seen...
Whoa, that's NDP bias right there.
What?
We didn't lose the seat. They had an election in Canada and win it. It's not as though they gave up the seat.
They lost the election, Elliot.
Did they lose it, Elliot? There's lots of decisions that go along with who's going
to
vote for who.
Absolutely, but to suggest they somehow lost the seat.
They did lose
the seat. Well, they did lose it.
They didn't have it and then lose it.
Okay, Elliot, I don't know what you're spinning
here. Do you work for Jason Kenney? Yeah. What's wrong with you? They lost the seat, and there's lots of decisions.
They lost the election to get the seat.
Okay.
I recognize
that. But it's semantics. They lost the election
to get
the seat.
If I was an MP and I lost my seat, that would make
sense. Let's say this.
If I lost the
election, Canada was on the Security Council. Canada is no longer on the Security Council.
Yes,
the reason why they did not get the votes to stay on the Security Council was because countries taking into account what you do around the world.
But I'm not arguing
your
that.
Peacekeeping.
Well, yes, you are.
Yes, you are.
No, I'm saying that they lost.
Just stop, Elliot. I was trying to set up the story.
Jesus.
And now you've cut in with this
you
ridiculous. I don't think we've ever got into an argument this quickly on the show.
This
is ridiculous.
Okay,
Elliot.
If I am not an MP,
Elliot, what's wrong?
Just
with
listen
you?
To me. No, if I am not an MP, and then I am running against you to be an MP, I didn't lose the seat. I lost
the election for that
seat.
Yes,
we now know the poll, okay?
Yes,
did Canada lose its seat?
We understand, Elliot.
I
have no time for the biased language on this show.
Oh, my God.
Elliot, you've been spending a little bit too much time with the Cheeto president, I think.
What I was saying is
that at one time, Canada was on the Security Council. Now, for words that I cannot use certain words, all I can say is now they are not on the Security Council. And when they left the Security Council, because I can't use the word lose, it was under the Harper Conservatives, all right? So now the Trudeau Liberals are trying to woo the permanent members of the Security Council, which include France, Britain, China, Russia, so are trying to get back onto that Security Council. And of course, they do have some pretty stiff competition against them, including Ireland. And is it Norway?
I believe it's Ireland and Norway.
Yeah.
And the general feeling is that Canada is actually the least likely of those three right now, how it's looking, because, as we were going to be going to, is that Ireland and Norway actually, in terms of diplomacy, have been doing a lot more than Canada in recent years. Norway is the biggest foreign aid donor in the world. They give over 1% of their GDP. Ireland has been really instrumental in a lot of peacekeeping efforts, which is something that Canada really prided itself. Actually, we still pride ourselves and say we're a peacekeeping nation, but actually Ireland excels us in terms of peacekeeping. Of course, the most recent thing was the Mali peacekeeping effort that Justin Trudeau and his administration thing, but it's kind of not a little too late, but we haven't been doing enough, of course, because we had Harper as, you know, prime minister, and our, you know, foreign aid, our diplomacy really went down in that time. So we're not really in good standing where they think that we could win that seat single-handedly.
So it's interesting to me because I see the pitch as sort of, you know, you're right, Sharon, the current level of humanitarian work isn't to the levels that it once was, but the pitch seems to be based on, look what we have done in the past. Yeah. You know, Canada does have a good legacy of peacekeeping, but, you know...
But some of the things they're saying is that Ireland has an unbroken record, I guess. So they've been consistent since, I think, 1958, whereas, again, because of the Harper government, we've fallen off.
Well, when we lost the seat. Oops, I can't use that word.
Yeah, exactly. When we lost in the election. There could be an option to seat share, apparently. So you can share a seat with another country, whether Ireland or Norway would go for that.
Well, I guess we should ask, though, would Canada go for that?
That's
the other, right? I mean, if it's as much as it is a good thing, you know, you want to be part of the Security Council, you know, for peace in the world, but it is a pride thing, you know, it is a thing of politics. Yeah. We don't want to share that seat. I think, you know, it is, again, a sign of certainly a change in tone in foreign affairs from the Trudeau Liberals. But the thing I take out of this is, you know, it's one thing to have that change in tone, but has there really been that concrete change in these types of humanitarian things that would warrant Canada's seat? Especially, you know, when we compare to Ireland and Norway, who are doing that good work.
I think a lot of times we talk about what we're doing, but I don't know if it's actually seen in our actions around the world. And I think Justin Trudeau faces a tough battle where he often can seem like someone who's like, oh, we're going to go save the world. And people are like, can you focus on things domestically? And he kind of gets sort of a bad rep for going on these missions or seeking these peacekeeping things or letting in Syrian refugees or whatever it may be. So maybe that has curtailed some of his administration's more aggressive aspirations for peacekeeping or diplomacy. What do you think, Elliot?
Well, I don't know. I think you guys just summed it up great.
Are you angry? Because
there's something odd here, folks. Let's say that.
Okay, so you guys have missed one key thing, which is in 2018, this year, they started the peacekeeping mission in Mali.
We said that.
I'm just saying that, but that's a major contribution to what's going on here. And that's clearly an indication that Canada is quote-unquote back on the map. And that you can throw back to what Trudeau said when he was initially elected, was that Canada is back, right? That's the notion that he tried to perceive. And the Liberals hit Harper hard on the Security Council seat. In fact, Michael hit Harper pretty hard on the Security Council seat when we first started the show way back 2.5-3 years ago now, and for good reason. I think it's a bit like this is a problematic situation for Justin Trudeau and the Liberals, and I'm thinking politically and I'm thinking domestically, because we've had a number of broken promises or underperforming promises that Justin Trudeau has made since he was elected, or when he was during the campaign in which he was elected. One of them was to get this seat back. And I think it's really imperative for the Trudeau government domestically and from a political position right now to have success on this file, and that people are worried and that there seems to be pushback or that it might not be happening, I think is really interesting right now. I think the Prime Minister and the Liberals are really in a damaged state. I think they've had a basically 12 to 16 months of consistent scandal. You've seen a rise in Andrew Scheer and the Conservatives, and I think this would be another blow to the current government if they didn't win this election.
I will say this, though. What they have going for them is the fact that the vote for the Security Council seat will happen after the 2019 election.
Yeah.
So, you know, voters, we will not be able to know about,
for sure.
You know. So, yeah. I mean, if that...
But if there are questions around, you know, Canada's legitimacy, that has to be pointed back to a prime minister that will be, you know, is in now his third year.
Yeah.
And whether it's fair or not to blame his government for them not getting the seat is another question, though.
Well, I mean, I guess yes and no. I mean, how vocal has he been? How vocal should he have been? I mean, obviously, there's conversations around how much do we want to spend on foreign affairs. There sort of seems to be this, like, Canadian nationalism floating about in particularly the East right now in Canada. So I think that that's had an impact as well. I mean, the truth is Canada is not the international player that it used to be. And, and it hasn't been for a while. I think we rode on the coattails of governments past.
Sure. Certainly.
Even through the Chrétien years and the Martin years. And then obviously Harper totally changed his tune. You have seen the Liberals sort of step away from that valiant support of Israel, at least publicly. Like, and that was one of the things that really impacted Canada's voter interest from other countries in the past, as Arab countries largely turned their back on Canada. Because of Harper's harsh stance in Israel. That has been less public, but I don't know that there's been any sort of major endorsement one way or another. The Trudeau government's largely stood neutral.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you have to be much more active than neutral nowadays to make a real stand.
You know, and you know, such major acts as the closing of the, severing diplomatic ties with Iran, which was a major event in the Harper foreign policy. Trudeau has not walked that back.
Yeah,
no.
So that severed
for sure
tie remains.
So
amongst other things.
So speaking on this thread of how Canada's showing up at the UN and some of the ways that we're not showing up great. Another thing that happened this week was Canada was one of the signatories on the U.S.'s global call to action on the world drug problem. And so this was a statement drafted by U.S. that Donald Trump presented. It wasn't drafted in the usual multilateral process that usually happens at these meetings. And the wording, apparently they say, was presented as non-negotiable. And this is basically a war on drugs statement. And so it emphasizes the role of law enforcement and criminalization as the way to fix the war on drugs problem. Canada did sign it, which was different than some of its closest allies like Germany, Norway, Spain. And some of the people who did sign it were Russia and the Philippines.
So a rogues gallery.
Yes, exactly. Okay. And of course, President Rodrigo Duterte, how do you say that?
Yeah.
Of course, his government has been going on a very strong war on drugs campaign. And it's reported about 17,000 people have been killed as part of his war on drugs. So these are some of the fun people that we've signed this statement with. And there was a lot of backlash, actually, from a lot of our allies and countries at the UN of Canada signing this statement.
So the war on drugs does not work. It's never worked.
What?
It's never made any sense.
Are you serious?
It's been bad policies from the beginning. And its origins are rooted in sowing racial degradation in the United States. So where members of President Nixon's administration used the use of drugs to go after groups that they didn't like leftist hippies and activist blacks.
Mm-hmm.
That's where this policy is ultimately rooted in. So to be endorsing this type of policy, one that comes from a government with a terrible history on pushing forward the idea of the war on drugs and not being honest about its true intention, is pretty disastrous and completely unbelievable. And as a Canadian, I'm really ashamed by this decision.
Yeah, I would say it is surprising, especially this government after, you know, the progressive feminist environmentalists.
Yeah.
You know, I this is a very tough issue, and obviously there was merits to signing it in the views of the Prime Minister of the government, you know, but you know, I think Ella brings up a good point that historically it hasn't worked. So you wonder what exactly were those reasons for the Prime Minister to want to agree to it.
Well, Switzerland was saying it's NAFTA. So Switzerland said the reason why Mexico and Canada signed this statement was because Trump is holding them hostage on NAFTA.
So is there's a vote of desperation.
Yeah, I think this would have hurt the NAFTA agreements, and maybe Justin Trudeau's government was like, okay, we'll pick our battles and maybe sign this, and maybe this will look good for
us. Which,
if they
didn't
sign it, you could see Trump, you know how he is, being like, oh, you know, are you really a partner of ours? But at what cost is my question, right? So the Trudeau government is legalizing marijuana as of October 17th, 19th, whatever that date is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Trudeau largely has said things that are opposite of what the statement has said. So does it matter, since the practices of the government in actuality don't match up with this policy? Or do you think that it does matter because it shows that, you know, we don't have a backbone?
If the practices of the government don't match the, you know, this, what they've just signed, then it's just an example of gross hypocrisy. If at the least.
I mean, I think that there's a real call right now, particularly given that we're in the middle of an opioid overdose crisis, to call on governments to decriminalize and in some places legalize drug flows and then start to regulate the drug market because of how the terrible shape that we're in. I mean, we just had reports last week, 11 Canadians dying a day. 11 people died today of an unintentional drug overdose. 2 in Alberta died today because of an unintentional drug overdose. So this policy, this way, criminalizing drug use, criminalizing going after people that use drugs and trying to throw them in jail, basically, you know, criminalizing the problem, is not working, and it has not worked. And when you endorse bad policy, it leads to bad policy choices. And I think that regardless of whatever impact this has had on NATO, and regardless of the relationship with the United States, we need a government that takes these kinds of issues seriously, that makes decisions based on evidence, or policy decisions based on evidence, and is a leader in the international community about these types of issues. And I haven't seen this, that this is not an indication of that from Justin Trudeau or the Liberals, regardless of the impact that it has on trade deals. I mean, you could say tit for tat, and there's some value in that for sure. I mean, that's mostly speculation. I don't know if that's actually true or not.
It's just speculation at this
but
point.
I think that, like, for me, when you want to talk about a UN Security Council seat, that's a seat for leaders in the community, leaders in the international community. And being a leader in the international community is not signing on to a drug policy that doesn't work. I just want to end this with a quote. We knew we couldn't make it illegal to be either against the war or black. But by getting the public to associate hippies with marijuana and blacks with heroin, and then criminalizing them both heavily, we could arrest their leaders, raid their homes, break up their meetings, and vilify them night after night on the evening news. Did we know we were lying about the drugs? Of course we did. That's John Ehrlichman, aide to President Nixon.
I think we have a Nixon point too in the White House right now, but we'll talk about him later on. Got 10 minutes and $100? Start planning your future with atbprosper.com. It's simple, easy, and built for you. The best parts? It's all online. There's a Prosper bonus, and there are ATB pros around to help if you want it. atbprosper.com. Check it out. Okay, so we're just going to highlight a very interesting and colorful chapter in provincial politics east in
New York. We're going even more east than Quebec last week.
You know, it's interesting. In general, I feel that we rarely do talk about the Maritime provinces or the Maritimes in general.
Shame.
I was trying to bring it up, but Michael and Sharon say, no, we're not talking about that.
Not even true.
Elliot is such an Atlantic defender. It's incredible. But
you might as well call me Seamus O'Regan 2.0.
Oh, my God.
So,
You see him and Michelle Rempel got in a great Twitter fight this week?
No, that's not what we're talking about right now.
Although that is an interesting discussion. Stay on topic. Let's go back to New Brunswick. So New Brunswick just had their provincial election, and it was the results that have, been very, very interesting and have spurred a lot of discussion, a lot of controversy. And, it's a discussion too on our system of governance. Of course, in Ottawa and in our provinces, we have the parliamentary Westminster system. So in situations that have arisen like that in New Brunswick, we kind of see the negative sides of the Westminster system and, when there's not a clear majority. So Sharon, what exactly happened?
Okay, so it was kind of fun because I remember us talking about, should we cover New Brunswick? And we're like, meh, like no shade to people from New Brunswick. But It was like, it's just election. It wasn't like Quebec where some of these issues around language and stuff were rising. But, look, New Brunswick proved us wrong because it's lit over there. So they had their election and there's a Liberal Party in power right now. So the Liberals have...
Well, we're the government.
Well, yeah, they were the government. And so the election happened, and you need 25 seats to get a majority. The Liberals got 21 seats, and the PCs got 22 seats. And then the Green Party and the People's Alliance Party each got 3. And so there is no majority.
So there is a minority, yes.
There is a minority. So... the Liberal Premier, Brian Gallant, went to the Governor General and said, hey, can I form government anyway? And they were told, yeah, sure, if you have the confidence of your parliament.
So I get that's the key point here. Yeah. I think we should stress is a party that has the confidence of the House, mm-hmm. the legislature, is the one that is asked to govern. And so, despite the fact that the Liberals did not win the most seats, so the Progressive Conservatives won more seats than the Liberals, Brian Gallant, convinced the Lieutenant Governor of New Brunswick that they would still be able to command confidence and therefore should still be able to govern. So, that is within the rules, but when you think of the fact that they have less seats in their forming government, is that right? So again, so that's what I was saying. Well, the downfalls of this kind of system, that these are the kinds of rules that allow for things like this to happen. Is it right?
That's a good question, Michael. And what's interesting is that Blaine Higgs, who is the PC leader there, actually said that, this isn't right. And
well, of course they wouldn't, right? But,
and he said that the lieutenant governor's office told him that, Gallant hadn't gotten permission to form government.
He hadn't, but he did visit.
Yes, but Higgs says that he didn't get the permission. And okay, so it's a whole back and forth. He said, she said sort of thing and says, it's unfortunate there's a delay. He's declaring that I am the premier-elect, while Gallant is saying, I am the premier.
Well, this was...
So we have two premiers. Yeah. We have two premiers in New Brunswick now.
The reality is that, obviously, with a minority, one of the parties is going to have to court, the smaller
courts
to get that balance of power to get that majority.
So this is the thing. Here's the thing, Michael. I disagree with Sharon. You're not asking a good question. Of course, this is right. This is how the system's supposed to work. You're supposed to bring people together.
What do you mean you disagree with me? I didn't even answer this question.
You said it was a good question. It's not a good question. This is how the system is supposed to work. This is how a parliamentary system works. You come together. You either get a majority or you don't. You have to build it. You have to build some sort of unity government. And then attempt to govern.
This is how it works, Elliot. It's the party, typically, the party with the most seats gets the first chance to govern.
Yes.
Okay? Would be the PCs
now, if they can't command confidence of the House, then the Governor General or the Lieutenant Governor has options to either call another election or call the opposition. Will they be able to form a government?
Exactly. Yes.
So what Gallant has done...
The PCs, in this case, have more seats. Yes, they should have the first option to form government.
But if you're saying I've got a deal with the Greens, or I'm gonna,
no,
I'm gonna
he doesn't have a deal. That wasn't,
but if he's saying he does, well, or he's no, gonna court
the
Greens.
Greens said, "We don't have a deal. The PCs and the Liberals are really rushing to things. We have lots of time. Really? Do you have lots of time? The voters want to go. They don't have that much time.
I mean, we get so worked up about this all the time. Whenever we get into a minority situation, oh my God, it's a constitutional crisis.
And well, we're talking
like this
about,
is how India does this once every 5 years.
We're talking about the process, though. What Michael is arguing is that the Liberals should not have gone and asked the lieutenant governor for this to happen.
To form government.
The PCs should have been the ones that were given the opportunity to form government because they have a majority by one.
Well, I guess that's fair. I mean, I think that's probably right. But if you've got the the support of a
party. What I took out of this was, and I admittedly...
The governor made a bad decision?
Well, I would think he did. I mean, but what I was going to say is my view of this, and this is I'm a person who doesn't follow New Brunswick politics, so I really don't know about these individual leaders very well. But it would seem a very arrogant thing for the Liberal premier to assume, I'm going to ask to form government because I was already in government and I already know what I'm, I already know the ins and outs of government. So to avoid a crisis or to avoid, more an extended period without.
Somewhat, but I think you're getting caught too much in the semantics of this because this is ultimately going to be a backroom deal one way or another. Either the Greens are going to shake hands with the PCs or the Greens are going to shake hands with the Liberals.
Right, okay, but that, and that is.
But
is
what's
totally
going to happen
fine.
Is there will be a formalized process in the House of Commons where the Governor General will say, Mr. Leader of the PCs, are you able to form government? And he's going to say yes. And then they're going to have a vote of confidence. And then he's going to lose. And then the Liberals, well, can you form government? He'll say, yes, I can. They'll have a vote of confidence and he'll win. That's sort of like the formalized process of it. But this is all backroom dealing and haggling. You end up with a Green Party
again,
member
but
in
for
cabinet
instance,
and a bunch
look
of different
at,
stuff
Let's
too.
Look at what happened in B.C., not too long ago.
Yes.
The same situation. John Horgan did not approach the BC Lieutenant Governor and say, before Christy Clark did, Christy, they now have more seats than the Liberals in this coalition with the Green Party in BC. But Christy Clark went to the governor, to the Lieutenant Governor first.
No, neither of them did. They both went to the Greens and said, join my party. And the Greens joined the NDP. I mean, formally, yes, Michael. Formally, yes, she did go and say, I do have permission to form government and blah, blah, blah. You do all that finagling. Going to the Lieutenant Governor is just a formality anyway. Ultimately, how this comes to be is a handshake deal between two
party
leaders.
And that's fine. My view again is that the right is not of the Liberal Party of New Brunswick to form government first. They do not have the first shot at government.
But what does it matter if the Greens agree to be with them? So sure, the PCs
but
get the first chance.
But that hasn't been formalized
they
yet, Elliot.
But it's not a formalized process. It's a backroom deal. It's which
but
part
should
is
it be?
Yeah, which part? Yeah, of course it is. That's how the parliamentary system works. You have a bunch of different parties, and you get representatives, and hopefully you have enough support to hold
fine,
the confidence.
But
the
it's
fair
what
confidence.
Happens.
I mean, going to the lieutenant governor, but maybe wasn't the appropriate thing to do to say I can form government. Sure, but it doesn't matter in the grand scheme of things. Ultimately, it's going to come down to a confidence vote, and by the people that were elected by constituents, right? Like, I don't see why you get worked up all about that.
That's
what's
not
interesting,
worked up, but it's a PR thing, right? It's how do we view things, And for a person who doesn't know the workings of the Westminster system, they are going to see the headline: PCs win more seats, Liberals form government. That's the issue here.
Well, they're not going to see that.
Well, that's what they'd like to say.
No, but that's what they'd like to say.
That's what it says.
But they
that
haven't
is
formed
what
government.
Is happening.
They haven't
that's
formed
what's
government.
Happened.
Yeah, they're going to though.
Well, I don't think they're.
Well, I don't know if they're going to, but it was put forward that we're going to continue.
I mean, there's just this.
That there's not a concession of defeat. You understand?
There's a schism between what's actually the formal process of the House of Commons and the government and sitting in there and a confidence vote quote unquote forming government in that situation and what actually is politics. What's actually going on here, which is. Gallant and the Liberals are outlining a set of policies that they think the Greens can buy into, may include parts of the Greens platform or promises that the Greens had made. and then the PCs will do the same thing. The Greens will make a decision, and that will be the party of power, whether they have the most seats or not. It's what the Greens decide because they hold the balance of power.
Yes, okay, but until that agreement, as you say, with the Greens is made, then we will just be in limbo. There is no government yet, but the Liberals have proclaimed themselves as government. Already before an agreement with
he
the
He already
Greens.
Did. He that's said, the, I'm still the
that's
Premier.
That's the problem.
Well, he's still
no,
the
and you're right, Elliot.
He's still
you're,
the Premier.
We have
Premier.
The government.
Right, yeah, but he should see, I'm the Premier of the, you know, the caretaker government until, you know, this is not, he's claiming to be the Premier of a new government. A government
while
that,
Higgs is claiming to be the Premier-elect.
You know, so...
It's
yeah.
a fun time.
I think
there.
There's also misunderstanding, perhaps, on the leaders' parts, and they don't even know how their own system works. In this case, you know, I mean, there's an assumption, perhaps, from Gallant that.
Well, I think the notion that the Liberals are trying to like steal the election is a little bit.
No one said that.
Well, Michael is sort of insinuating.
We know
that.
You have connections in the federal Liberals, okay?
Yeah, I'm a big New Brunswick Liberal yeah. supporter.
You need to disclose.
Seamus,
no, but it's funny.
2.0.
The liberal,
right here.
But the liberals okay. have a history of doing this. So yes, ooh. I was looking this up just a bit earlier, and this happened in 1925 at a federal election. Prime Minister William Lyon Mackenzie King got less number of seats than the Progressive Conservatives, but yet, and he lost his own seat in the 1925 what? General election. Yet still. Went on to govern because, you know, there's exactly the same situation here in New Brunswick. He did form a governing majority with the other parties in the
19th. But that's not stealing. That's how the system's supposed to work.
But it but yes, yes, Elliot, yes. But perhaps then we should talk about if that's how the system works, then
is
the system.
Is our system broken, guys?
This is coming
that
from
is
a. This is
question.
By the way, folks, and we'll move on after this. But I want to say
Elliot
that this
has
is
his head
this
in
is
his
coming
hands.
From a guy who says that there's nothing wrong with the electoral system in this country, right? But you know, if we had perhaps a system that yielded results that wouldn't end in these
a
kind
proportional
of,
representation, then you still would need a unity government. Okay. You still would need a unity government. In fact, more often, and there'd be more often people with fewer seats. Saying, I'm going to govern. It would happen more often in government, in a proportional system.
Okay.
So we're getting all worked up about this
then,
work.
But then what is the definition then of a true democracy when a party gets more votes, yet does not govern? That's all I'm saying. Yes, it's part of our system. Elliot is absolutely correct.
But you're confusing
correct.
Majority and more votes. Like, you know, what's, you know, you have 30% of the total votes, let's say, which is enough to win the more seats than someone else, but not a majority. I don't know what the voter breakdown is there. That's not a majority. You don't have majority support. You have more support than anyone else.
Yeah, yeah.
But ideally, in this situation, you could have 28% of the total vote and partner up with someone else who's got 13, and then you do have majority support.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is the way it should work, which is democracy.
Okay. Well, then why don't you call
slag
up...
Slag our governmental
why don't you,
system.
Why don't,
slag the Westminster system.
Call,
what, you want to go to America where you get
why don't
the,
you call,
let, you get more in the popular vote and still lose the election?
Call Premier Gallant, Elliot, and let him know then what, you know, how the rules work.
You know what? It's
because,
up to the Green
no,
Party
because
now.
You seem
it's
to,
up
you,
to the Green
you're
Party
obviously
now.
A master of these parliamentary rules, so call the Premier and let him know how it works.
Well, you go to the
because
lieutenant
I'm
government.
Not sure. I'm not sure that he exactly knows what's happening.
Okay,
perhaps
we're over
not.
This topic now.
Yeah, well, you know, to another controversial topic, and we'll go to the United Kingdom. I'm going to put a question mark on that because ooh. Is it really a United Kingdom? So the major headache that's been circling Britain, of course, for 2 years now is Brexit. So we all know they voted to leave in a very contentious decision. And Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, you know, her big task is negotiating this deal to leave the European Union, which is supposed to happen in March of 2019. And
but it doesn't appear as though that is going to happen.
Oh, my God.
Yes, that's absolutely right, Elliot.
What is happening?
The British government, the which
Karen,
is a
British
the,
accent.
The,
oh.
the British government of Theresa May, the conservative minority government, again, being supported by a Northern Irish party in Parliament.
Because they got together, they went to the...
Yes. Okay.
They hashed out a plan. Theresa May's government hashed out a plan called the Chequers Plan. Which is, you know, their proposal to the European Union.
Certainly wasn't a chess plan, that's for sure.
No. It's their proposal to the European Union as to what kind of relationship the Union will have with the United Kingdom as they approach Brexit. And, you know, it's been met with opposition from within the Conservative Party, her own Conservative Party. Members that have quit include Boris Johnson, the foreign secretary, for one of the most vocal Brexit supporters.
And the individual leading the Brexit talks, right, from her government.
That's right.
I forgot the gentleman's name.
So, needless to say, there is an internal strife within the Conservative Party over her plan, the Chequers plan, and there's backlash from the European Union itself, who are rejecting the Chequers plan.
For sure. So she's basically stuck.
She's attacked on both sides.
Yeah. Because from her government, there is the criticism that the plan doesn't go far enough to separate them a clean break from the EU. And so they say that the Chequers plan is soft because what she basically proposes, you know, kind of keeping most things the same. Obviously, there's things around, you know, travel and borders that need to be tweaked. But it wasn't a really aggressive exit from the EU. In theory, not much would change on paper and in practicality. And so her government saying this doesn't go far enough, we need a complete exit. And then the EU is saying this can't happen, this is going to what's the term, this is going to infringe on our single market, our single market freedom and policy here. You have people saying the whole Northern and Southern Ireland thing is probably one of the biggest things that
because
cause
of the borders,
a problem because of the borders. So when you think about tariffs and like how are you going to tariff this like one place, it's a mess.
Yeah, so
it is a mess.
That's a great analogy. Of course, the cliche rock in a hard place, but it is true. Mm-hmm. Because for Theresa May, who are you pleasing?
Yeah.
Somebody is going to be angry. Somebody is not going to be happy. So, you know, is she going to please the Union or, you know, please members of her own party? Because her government is in a precarious position, right? It could fall really any time. Of course, the opposition Labour movement, Labour Party, has said that, you know, they are willing to topple the government and, if possible, would call a second Brexit referendum, probably maybe undo the whole thing, right? So it's very, very complicated. I would actually liken this Chequers plan. You know, I studied a lot of Quebec sovereignty, and one of René Lévesque, when he was proposing Quebec sovereignty, the term he used was sovereignty association. So Quebec would be independent, but have this association with Canada, which would include the open borders, the shared currency. And the Chequers plan, to me, really, you know, that's that came
like that
to mind, right? It's, you know, we still want to be friends, European Union, you know, this kind of thing. And obviously we're seeing from the hardliners in her Conservative Party that there's no room for friendship.
But this is exactly, this is fundamentally like the exact reason why you do not govern through referenda. Because it leads to society.
Yeah,
now, I know she didn't call the referendum. She's picked up the ball that she still wanted to be prime minister, though. So you can't say as though she doesn't have any responsibility in this whatsoever. She wanted this job. She wanted this task. She believed. She convinced everyone in her own party that
she
could do
face?
It.
What's his face? Who was it?
David Cameron.
David Cameron called this
on.
But this is the kind of bullshit that happens when you do this.
Totally.
Politics is not, and policy decisions, and particularly major trade policy, cannot be decided by the masses. It just doesn't make any sense. It leads to cleaves. And I think what's happened here is that Theresa May is unfairly undermined because she doesn't have the power that a normal prime minister would, because there's this overhanging sort of cloud of energy around the idea that the people called for this. And so everyone who voted for it believed it was going to be one way or another, when that wasn't clearly articulated, at least, you know, fully anyway. And so everyone believed it was going to be something than what it actually was. And when we've come to, she's come to this position and she's completely undermined. On top of the fact that I'm sure MPs in her own caucus are hearing from people in the ridings that they actually don't want to do this. So she's undermined, her power's undermined in her own caucus as well, which is a whole other issue to this. And it's just an example of why major policy decisions can't be made by large groups of people. That's why you elect experts. That's why you have bureaucracies. That's why you work, you know, you have a will and a wish and something that you want. But if you want to make major changes or you want, it takes political leadership. And when you don't have political leadership, people who don't have leadership skills or are scared to tackle tough issues call referenda, and this is the outcome.
So I take it that the notion of a second redo referendum, you think that would obviously be just
that's a bad idea.
Silly.
Well, the goal would be obviously just to have a referenda to have everyone reevaluate their decision, decide they don't want to do Brexit, so it would get the government out of this mess.
Of course, that would
be the goal, right? And I think you'd have a lot more young people show up. You'd have people on the left who thought that, you know, Brexit, there was no way they were going to lose their referendum, so they didn't vote or didn't really engage or didn't fully recognize what Brexit was going to mean to their country.
You know,
they would engage
the day after the Brexit vote. You know, like, that was one of the top searched words on Google. What is Brexit? Mm-hmm. People didn't even know what it was. They didn't really realize the consequences of it.
Yeah.
Well, and that's exactly it now. But so you call a referendum so that you can get the result that you want. Hardly democratic.
And, you know, even if this referendum, even if there's another referendum called and Brexit goes away, the underlying issues that caused Brexit and the underlying issues that are making this plan, this Brexit, difficult are still there. Borders is one of the biggest things that, you know, people from Theresa May's government is saying the reason why they don't like her plan is because the borders are too open to the EU, which was caused, of course, by a lot of migrants and people coming in from Poland and different places like that to work in Britain. And that's still going to be a problem. Her government's still going to have to face this issue of, a lot of it is racism and xenophobia.
Yeah, I was going to say, really, the Polish, we're going to use the Polish as the example of why people are getting
mad. But actually, that is one thing. The Polish are a big problem, not a big problem, but people in the UK see that, a lot of people see them as a problem because a lot of Polish people come there, they work, they send money back, they, you know, take the jobs
Take my job.
Yeah. Oh my God.
At the bakery. It used to be mine. Now it's some Polish
guy. And lots of other people from, like, Eastern Europe, that's a big issue that a lot of people in the UK say that they really hate that. Borders is still going to be a problem. And all these underlying issues that they say caused Brexit. So what is Theresa May's government going to do if she still is the leader and in power, even if Brexit is repealed?
And one thing she has constantly said is that a no deal will be better than a bad deal, of course. And, you know, we've even heard Trudeau say that about NAFTA and such. So, but, you know, the question is that true? Is that true? No deal is better than
I guess
a bad deal.
For who.
You know?
Yeah. I think May's time is limited.
Well, and this is posturing. Part of this, too, is the EU isn't going to just agree to anything.
No.
And they know that there's a time limit. Yeah, there's a time limit around how long May's going to be around, how much political appetite in the UK there is for this type of a deal. With every day that this goes on and passes, the UK's hands get, and Theresa May's hands get weaker in the negotiation. So, I mean, like, if you're sitting there and you're part of the EU negotiating group and you're one of the major countries, there's no reason why you should feel like you need to take a hit in order to appease a bunch of British citizens. I mean, they made the decision to want to leave, but they don't certainly get to set the terms, and they're starting to realize that they don't just get to set the terms. That's not how it works. You're part of a collective, and this is a decision that was made, you know, how old's the EU now? 25, 30, 35 years now.
Old.
Yeah. So this is that's one of the struggles with it, is that you don't just, there's no such thing as a clean break, and there's nothing that's going to be easy, and there's no reason why European Union countries should have to take a hit because of a small minority in the group.
Yeah. So this this is going to continue. This is a very dramatic situation, so keep an eye on it. March is that date of Brexit, but will there be a deal? I'll also say this, I would expect possibly a British election you know, before then. So, and if there is a change in government, how that will affect these negotiations. So very interesting to watch.
Put the tea on and turn on the telly. It's going to be a long winter in London.
The Alberta Podcast Network, powered by ATB, has been bringing us awesome podcasts from all across Alberta for a little over a year now. And this week, we said goodbye to one of the first shows that was part of the network, The Broadcast, hosted by Trisha Eastbrooks, Esther Brooks, and Alex Zabchek. That podcast was a place for women to tell their stories about life in and around politics, and it will be sorely missed. So farewell to The Broadcast. Good luck in what's ever next. And if you'd like to hear more podcasts from all across Alberta, visit the albertapodcastnetwork.com.
Right, so Elliot has been sharing his acting abilities tonight. Very good, Elliot. I'm very impressed. Very impressed with your accents. Can you do an impression of the 45th president? Because it is time for
Trump Watch.
No, I can't do a Donald Trump. Come on, try. I'm not going to try. You do a much better Donald Trump.
I don't think so. Well, I mean, I know the way he speaks, but I don't know if I can get his voice at all. I'm not going to try. I don't want to bring his essay. I don't want to be... I really feel, very badly when we do this segment, you know, talking about this man. So I don't want to speak like this man. I'll pass, Elliot.
You're fired.
Yeah,
you're fired.
So huge. What? Huge. China.
So Elliot, what's our Trump watch this week?
I don't know. I forget. Oh yes, God. I do remember.
You are really on one today.
I am not in. I'm not in my best shape right now. Let me just pull up the article. But basically,
you're reading it from an article. Thank you.
Okay. All right, Sharon, you just do it.
Oh my gosh. So the Trump administration has opened up a formal review of fetal tissue research. And basically what this is a kind of pro-life bullshit. But so what happens when people choose to have an abortion? The government, the FDA, can purchase some of the fetal tissue from abortions to be able to help in scientific research. This scientific research is very important because a lot of things that they might test on mice or whatever, things like that, don't really work as effectively than testing it on humans. So things like how polio, the effects of polio on children, different kinds of diseases, different kinds of illnesses that scientists have been able to make a breakthrough are because of a lot of stem cell and fetal tissue research. And so recently the FDA put in a contract to purchase about $16,000 worth of fetal tissue, which is relatively small in the grand scheme of things. But the Trump administration basically was like, oh my God. And they canceled that contract and are doing a formal review of these purchases. And this is causing quite an alarm with a lot of health agencies and the scientific world, because obviously this research is very important. Scientific research is the reason why a lot of us, you know, can get sick and, you know, be okay the next day and we don't die from, you know, random basic viruses. And on many fronts, this is, again, another example of how the Trump administration's decisions have greater impact for everyday people right now, but also in the future. So what do you think about this, guys? Do you think, along with some of the other stuff, that this is one of the first kind of subliminal attack on science that's happening in the Trump administration?
No, it's absolutely not the first. and it's not even the first attack on a woman's right to choose or undermining the credibility of doctors and scientists who perform abortions. I mean, look at the current nominee to the Supreme Court has been pretty open about his opposition to the Roe v. Wade decision. And many believe that if he doesn't, he isn't part of the legal team that ultimately overturns the decision completely, he will work to systematically undermine the ruling in a number of different ways if he does become a justice, along with the other right-wing justices on the court.
Yeah.
So I think that, first and foremost, obviously that's a big issue. You know, it's reminded of the stem cell debate and George W. Bush shutting down stem cell research for moral reasons or something like that, and then...
the huge outcry when Barack Obama overturned that decision really early in his presidency.
Yeah,
in
that 2008 was awesome.
As well, too. I mean, for me, it's... I'm just glad I'm not an American. I'm so glad we don't have to continually... I mean, I think we do continue to litigate these questions and these social issues and these moral issues in Canada, and maybe it's even worse because it's not in the general public sphere. In fact, many of the people that hold these views hold them quite close to their chest and run for nominations in UCP ridings. But otherwise, we don't have to deal with it in our main media. There aren't Susan B. Anthony groups that are coming out and in favor of these sorts of issues too. I think it'd be really frustrating to be a woman right now in the United States. And this is ultimately just a way to, it's clever and it's insidious because of how clever it is, because it's using sort of the issue as an abortion. It's making the issue abortion without making abortion the issue. And that is, insidious and really something that you have to be mindful of. It's never, Donald Trump's a dumbass, and he wears his emotions on his sleeve, and you know how he's feeling about everything all the time. But it's these types of people, the people that push for these types of reviews and use these types of issues to undermine social change, yes, that I think is really where you have to be looking, because it's the worst form of it.
Yeah, well, and you have to wonder too, with Donald Trump himself, say it's the people behind him. Does he even really realize what this is all about? He has to be sat down and told, this is what we're going to be doing,
Yeah.
Which was similar sentiments during the George W. Bush administration, that, the war in Iraq was really orchestrated by Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell, Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney. Those were the guys that were planning it, and just the face of it was George W. Bush, right, as the president. Yeah. He was the one calling the orders, but where were the orders coming from? Certainly, Trump is the one who likes to take credit for all these things. But, these clever, insidious things, I'm not sure Trump is the most intellectually gifted to perhaps come up with these kinds of things.
For sure. And the other thing that raised for me is some of the really outrageous rhetoric and the sound bites that come out of this. Some of the quotes from this decision. Do you have some of these, Elliot?
Hold on. I had one here for a bit.
Yeah,
but then
it's just ridiculous. And some of the wording that you can see is very Fox News-esque.
Unborn children are not commodities to be bought and sold. The practice of conducting research using the body parts of children whose lives have been violently ended by abortion is abhorrent.
The great accent.
That's my Jeff Sessions.
I was going to say it. Very good.
I love it. Yeah, children being bought and sold, babies' lives violently ending. Like, this kind of very flagrant rhetoric is very...
Whenever you see those images of the bloody fetuses on the side of a truck.
And it riles people up, further splits people on this issue, when really, that's not what's happening. There's no children being bought and sold. It's just it's disappointing, and I think it further divides people, this kind of language. But it's the way that the media a lot of times and the Trump administration talks, and it's to rally up their base, right? And it's pretty shitty.
I think you're miscategorizing the types of people that we're talking about here. These are just good Christian loving Americans.
Elliot is...
all right.
I don't know.
Tonight 7-8-0, guys.
Yeah, Elliot, you need to collect your thoughts, man.
My God.
All right, so I got a 7-8-0. And it's not a 7-8-0, it's a 4-0-3. Because it's for all of our listeners in Calgary.
Pew, 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 pew. Just kidding, I'm not booing. Pew, pew, pew. Shout out to my mom in Calgary.
And yeah. Sharon's friends. And my family.
No, just my mom.
Just Sharon's mom.
Thank you.
And Heather. Isn't Heather in Calgary?
Yeah.
Hi, Heather. So, if you're in Calgary, there's a show going on right now called The Virgin Trial. It is an
a modern take, a historical drama on Queen Elizabeth I and the controversy that was the attempted murder or capture of her brother Edward, and sort of that very tumultuous time in the British crown's history.
He was a 12-year-old boy that became king.
Yeah, right? Yeah, and then he was, there was a bunch of stuff. And so there's the story revolves the implication that Elizabeth was somehow involved in his attempted capture. It's a really awesome show, and I would really encourage people in Calgary who enjoy theater to go and see that show. And hey, if you're not doing anything over the weekend, it runs through the weekend, and it's, you know, I made it a weekend adventure last weekend, and I was really happy.
You look like you had fun.
Elliot, you went to Calgary, right? You were with the UCP caucus?
Yes. That's why we were planning, our run, and so that we're ready to end the job-killing carbon tax.
And you were, going through the photo album of your time in India, right?
It was a great time. It was a great time.
I love it. Okay, so my 7-8 of this week, speaking of Heather, actually goes out to my BFF Heather. If you're into curling or you're just into sports, I encourage you all to turn on Sportsnet this weekend or illegally stream it. I don't know. I don't care. Heather's team Chelsea Carey, is at the Elite 10 Grand Slam of Curling competition in Ontario, and it's televised. The biggest names in curling are going to be playing in this tournament, so really exciting. Can't wait to watch her on TV, and just really a shout out for you to support Canadian athletes, people. Come on, watch them.
I mean, the best way to support Canadian athletes would be paying to watch them.
Well, I go to the games in person, you know. I don't want to give Bell or Rogers Media my money. Okay, so my other 7-8 actually goes to...
Oh my God, now she's got two.
I also have two, so it's
my rousing defeat of Elliot in both of our fantasy leagues that we play against.
You can't give yourself a 7-8-0.
So,
object.
Elliot always seems to bring up fantasy football on the podcast, so I decided to do it
always trying to
this
me.
Time because Elliot is really tanking this year. He is playing horribly, making bad decisions, and I was victorious.
You don't play fantasy football. I'm not on the field.
I mean, so it's okay. So shout out to my team. Shout out to beating Elliot, and that's
okay. Well, if you're both gonna have to, I have another one too. Nope, my 7-8-0 goes out to Matt.
Who is Matt?
Matt's a longtime listener for
Matt Slingbot. That's his Twitter, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
No, I think it's a different Matt.
Oh, awkward.
It's a friend of ours, a coworker of mine who's been listening to the show for 2 years.
Got it.
Anyway. Shout out to Matt.
This show.
All right. Mine.
Take us away. All right.
So my first
Michael.
One is just a quick a movie recommendation for Michael Moore's latest Fahrenheit 11/9, and of course, it's a look at the Trump presidency, but more so, it is a look at the American political system, the American political culture that allowed Donald Trump to be elected. Now, of course, we know, Michael Moore presents his works with bias, so, that's obvious. But, it's hard to deny the effectiveness of his arguments. The movie is very striking. It's emotional. It's inspirational. So I highly recommend Fahrenheit 11/9. It's it's a sad look, but it's an encouraging look at America and where we are heading. And my second one is for the real Star Wars fans out there. You may have heard that Gary Kurtz passed away. Gary Kurtz was producer of the first Star Wars: A New Hope, 1977, and The Empire Strikes Back, 1980. And he is important, I think, really for the fact that Star Wars was able to make it as a film. George Lucas came forward with a number of pretty audacious ideas, and studios did not want to finance the project. And Gary Kurtz, he was a young producer, and he meets with this young director, George Lucas, and he has faith in him, and he believes in his product, and it helps him finance the first Star Wars movie and The Empire Strikes Back. And he was also influential in getting George Lucas to flesh out the concept of the Force. George Lucas had been playing around with the idea of the mystic religion, and Gary Kurtz, who had also studied comparative religions and world religions, really helped George Lucas, you know, come up with the Force as we know it, that living spirit that was within all creatures in the Star Wars universe, and, you know, really one of the most beloved features of Star Wars. So Gary Kurtz passed away the other day, certainly a very influential figure in the creation of Star Wars. You know, if it wasn't for Gary Kurtz, if it wasn't for George Lucas, these pioneers, we wouldn't have the current movies that we have. So
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, it was important to remember the originators. So
pour one out for the homies.
May the Force, now Gary Kurtz is now one with the Force. Rest in peace. All right, so this has been episode number 141. Elliot has been really unhinged this week. Seriously, I something was in his water tonight.
Yeah,
but,
definitely.
You can, you know, reach him at on Twitter. And what is your Twitter handle?
At TantyYEG. That's TantyYEG.
Yes, and I am at Maestro Michael 2.
How do you spell that?
Maestro Michael AEL.
Sharon.
Just before I say my Twitter handle, we did do a poll last week. And
we did.
Yeah, it's so, low turnout though.
Yeah, low turnout on the poll. So we might
maybe if you guys put out the poll when you're supposed to put out the poll.
So we might be rethinking our poll approach. So please give us any feedback if you have it. But we discussed Quebec's election on episode 140 and asked, can the sovereignty movement escape ultimate extinction? And everyone who responded to the poll said yes, but only with new leadership.
Right.
Awesome. The other option was no interest is gone. So no one thinks that they're, you know, the interest for Quebec sovereignty
has gone
away. But if you'd like to give us feedback on polls or anything else, you can find me at Sharon MVU on Twitter.
That?
And you can find the show at High Level Show.
That's SHARONMVU.
And if you we also have a vacancy for a new host.
Yeah,
so Elliot, we're going to have to review his
his
contract with us, because tonight was very unprofessional. Yeah.
So thank you so much for joining us, everyone. We apologize for Elliot. See you next week.
Good night.